Listen to Today with Sean O'Rourke with the RTE Radio Player.
EU Ombudsman Emily O'Reilly is in Dublin this morning. She was addressing the Association of Higher Civil and Public Servants on the topic of women in leadership in a new decade. Good morning to you, Emily O'Reilly. Thank you indeed for coming in. Tell me about the focus of that address. What do you see as the key targets for women in this new decade, as opposed to maybe the way you might have seen things 10 years ago?
Well, I mean, I think the fact that we even are talking about female leadership as opposed to just general leadership is indicative that something is still wrong. I mean, I left school, as I confessed to them this morning, in 1975. And so my early professional life was in the 70s and 80s, when Ireland wasn't that much involved in relation to equality for women in the workplace. But obviously there is a lot of equality now, and a lot of women have reached the highest levels in many sectors. And yet I still find, particularly with younger women, that there is still this diffidence, this lack of confidence, this kind of unwillingness to see themselves in particular roles. And I suppose that's what I was trying to get across. And, you know, I saw all of the women who were there this morning. There was quite a lot of them. And they all hold now, I suppose, middle management rankings in the public sector, in the civil service. And I said I was a bit worried, but so many of them there, who was running the country, you know. But I suppose it was just to explore that, and to explore, I suppose, as they say, you know, one's own journey in relation to these things.
Yeah, actually, we were talking about the Irish Times a few minutes ago. There's a very interesting piece there in that paper today by a woman. I'm just going through it. The section has fallen out. But anyway, she's talking about lots of serious matters. But in the course of it, she writes about how she was home for Christmas and the dinner was served, and all the men got served first, including her brother, who was 10 years younger than her. And she just, that's the way it is, or has been. It's just a small measure.
But it is extraordinary. I mean, one of the things I face as European ombudsman, a lot of ombudsmen in Europe have a legal background, and we don't traditionally in Ireland, or indeed in the UK. So sometimes I'm accused of not being a lawyer. And I was discussing this one time with my predecessor, who was an academic and not a lawyer. But this man was an older man, about 6'4", you know, very patrician looking and so on, an academic. And he said to me, "But Emily, I'm not a lawyer." And I said, "I know, but you look like one," you know. So even the male presence can itself give leadership, no matter how thick you might be.
Her name was Paula Gahan, by the way, a writer and comedian based in London, a very fine piece. Yeah. As I say, it's dealing with much more than who got served the dinner first. But in any event, and of course, you've now got the European Commissioners headed by a woman, Ursula von der Leyen. Now, I was chatting earlier to Chris Patten. I don't know if you met him on the way out, about the UK and the trade talks with the EU and so forth. But you were speaking to the Business Post of the weekend, and you say that the EU has a PR job to do. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think it's more that there is a need for people to have a much greater understanding of what goes on at EU level. I mean, I know this is a something that we've said for decades, and people traditionally find the EU a bit impenetrable. It's over there. It's hard to understand. But there are so many things that are vital to us at the moment that are currently under discussion, whether it's the long-term EU budget, or whether it's this new climate fund to hold, and of course the EU-UK Brexit talks, that unless people have a deeper understanding of how things work, particularly at council level. I mean, we know about the Commission, we know about the Parliament, but council is actually where our own ministers go over and do the deals and devise legislation and agree to things that ultimately impact on us. And yet there's very little conversation about it or discussion about it at national level.
But do we not get it reported to us through our correspondents, like our own more than excellent Tony Connolly? Our people, they get briefings, they're told what goes on at council meetings.
Well, they are and they're not. And I have to say, pay a tribute to Tony Connolly. I know that there was some apparent criticism of it of him a few weeks ago, which I think the MEP involved apologised for. Tony is excellent, but there are actually very few Irish correspondents over there. And Brexit has been a huge focus of the reporting over the last number of years, and rightly so. But there are huge swathes of important matters matters and issues that happen in Brussels, in the institutions, that we really aren't aware of. And I know they get briefings. I remember I used to go to those council meetings as well and be briefed by PJ Mara and those guys from the past. But actually, our level of understanding wasn't necessarily that high, and what was being briefed was usually quite minimal. So unless you really get down into the detail, you're really not going to have a full understanding of what's going on.
And in other words, if there's some measure which might be desirable and would be welcomed by the public, you don't necessarily know if your own government is the one that's most vehemently opposed or entrenched against
you're it. You're absolutely right. It's hands across the homework, you know. So, I mean, there was one case, I use this to sort of illustrate what goes on. There was a complaint that came to us. It was an access to documents or a freedom of information request. And people, the person looking for the documents was looking for documents in relation to the member state's position in relation to advice given about bees and pesticides. Pesticides are killing the bees are in crisis, and therefore the biodiversity is in crisis, and that affects all of us. Now, this advice was given to the Commission nearly 7 years ago. It was given to the Council nearly 7 years ago, and it's been stuck there. So we said to the Commission, who held the documents on behalf of the Council, we said, you should release the member state positions to find out, is Ireland holding it up? Is it Bulgaria? Is it France? Whatever. And the Commission hummed and hawed, and I think in fairness to them, did go back and forth to the Council and said they recognised the public interest and people knowing about this, but they held that there was a higher public interest in keeping the deliberative process secret, essentially. And I can understand that if the deliberative process started 6 months ago, but not 7 years ago. So therefore, because of this level of secrecy at council level, we are not enabled to know what positions our governments are taking. And when important issues relevant to all of us are being dealt with, what's holding it up? And if we don't know who or what is holding it up, then we can't seek to influence as we would with a normal piece of domestic legislation.
But I suppose there can be all kinds and all manner of interlocking diplomatic efforts going on. You might have a particular objective to do with maybe fishing, and you know you need to marshal your diplomatic support, and the French might support you on something, and well, the British when they were there would be helpful on something else, and you know the whole thing operates on a kind of a network.
Yeah, you're absolutely
right. And
the
less the public know, the better.
Yeah, through the diplomatic prism, I'll give you bees if you give me fish, you know, or I'll support you on this piece if you support me on that. And I mean, I think that's the great existential argument that is put forward in relation to this. But at the same time, they have to balance that out. Obviously, the need to do deals with 27 member states, it's very difficult and it's very challenging. And I recognise that. But if people don't know what's going on, that dilutes the legitimacy of the institutions and of the EU. And therefore, we have things like we had in the Brexit referendum, when the whole thing, you know, was on a bedrock of ignorance and prejudice, really.
And some of it, if you like, fomented. I mean, Boris Johnson built a whole career around his time in Brussels, doing makey-uppy stories, or flyers,
exactly,
as we used to call them in the trade.
And in those days, there were a lot of UK correspondents. They saw that Boris was getting great traction and fame, let's face it, from the manner in which he was mediating, you know, the straight banana story caricature of the EU. And some of them followed suit. And the result was that a caricature of the EU grew up, which was very difficult to demolish in the few weeks of referendum campaign.
Didn't that suit all British governments that have been there, pretty much of whatever hue? I mean, one of the great services I ever did to journalism was to leave the Irish Press, because then you came in as the political correspondent. But before I did that,
so kind.
I used to go to these Brussels, these briefings in places like Brussels, and then more exotic places like Fontainebleau. And I remember there was a guy called John Dickey. He was the diplomatic editor of the Mail, the Daily Mail, and he was kind of the doyen of the correspondents who would show up for Bernard Ingham's briefings in Mrs. Thatcher's day. And Ingham would sweep into the room, and John Dickey would always ask the first question. He'd say, "Well, Bernard, another great triumph for British diplomacy, I presume." And I mean, that's what Mrs. Thatcher did. It started here in this capital city of Dublin when she became Prime Minister. I want my money back.
Yeah.
And it was ever thus with the
Brits. But what Boris Johnson used to say, he'd come sweeping into a press conference and said, "What's going on and why is it bad for Britain?" and whatever
same
it was,
story.
It was going to be bad for Britain.
Yeah, and then it became, I suppose, difficult for David Cameron to get the kind of deal he wanted and to sell the idea that that Europe was a good thing for Britain to be part of, because
he
presented, I've got to get these concessions.
Exactly, and the few weeks or months after the referendum result, I mean, I was reading lots of stories about people being surprised that the local community hall was, you know, funded by by some EU grantor that their child was in Netherlands courtesy of an Erasmus grantor, and all of these things that they simply didn't know. As I said, the caricature of the EU that was developed had the impact that it had. And the point I've been making is that they have to be a little braver. They really have to open their processes a little more to the public, so that the public can have a little more engagement with them, and that the legitimacy of the EU can be strengthened.
Yeah, but I mean, a little closer to home than the UK, you get people railing against the notion that we can't cut our turf in our bogs to keep our home fires burning, all because of Europe. That's part of what you're up against.
Of course. I mean, I think you're going to get even more of that in the next few years, because we have this climate fund and the huge climate target that has been put there by the Commission for the EU to be carbon neutral by 2050. And I think a series of policy initiatives are going to be rolled out even over the next few weeks. And you can imagine the trading that is going to take place in relation to that. So people shouldn't be ignorant. I mean lacking in knowledge about it, and people actually really need to get in there and find out what our governments, what our representatives are doing in relation to it, and try and understand the process and understand the trades. And because these decisions are so vital for us that it's wrong that they should be continually done behind closed doors.
Yeah, but one, I think you've got three main priorities for your new term, a new 5-year term, which began there just before Christmas: climate emergency, defence, and migration. Again, on migration, we saw the political difficulties that Angela Merkel got into, and other countries as well, as a result of the kind of openness there was to people coming in desperate straits from, be it Syria or elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean,
that has filtered through to this country.
Of course, and it is very challenging. And then, of course, you had the deal that was done with Turkey, whereby by Turkey would take back a lot of the migrants that had arrived in Greece and so on. A lot of people were sort of wondering about the ethics of that, shall we say. But where my role comes in, you see, on the one hand, you have the treaties, you have all the EU values, you have the Charter of Fundamental Rights, and then you have the problem like migration. And you have the EU border agency, Frontex, which is now being empowered to do a much stronger job in relation to essentially keeping people out, protecting them, of course, but essentially keeping them out. They are being granted an additional 10,000 border guards over the next few years. Now, they will be EU personnel. Frontex is an EU institution, it's an EU agency. And it has to abide by its obligations under the law, of course, but under the Charter of Fundamental Rights. So you can see where the challenges are going to come there. And that's an area that I will be looking at.
I suppose politicians can be the same everywhere, be they in Ireland, be they at the highest echelons of the European Union. You caught the last president of the... Maybe you did catch him out in... effectively pulling a stroke about an appointment. You had an inquiry, you conducted an inquiry into a promotion that raised eyebrows, the head of the civil service getting another job that wasn't really meant for a political appointee. Just tell us about that.
Well, this relates to Martin Selmayr, who had been the chef de cabinet of the former Commission President Juncker, a very, very brilliant man, a very brilliant civil servant who'd been fast-tracked through the ranks because he was and is an excellent civil servant. But however, Mr. Juncker decided that he wanted him to be his Secretary General, which is the head of the EU administration, or the Commission administration. And this was done in a way that did not abide with the rules. So there was quite a lot of controversy in relation to that. We got a complaint. We dealt with it. The recommendation I made was not in relation to Mr. Selmayr, but rather that the next time they move to select a Secretary General, they do it in accordance with the rules. They rejected that recommendation. However, when the new commission came in under President von der Leyen, they appointed a new Secretary General. Mr. Selmayr, in the meantime, had been moved to the EU office in Vienna. And this time time they appointed the Secretary General in accordance with the rules.
And a lot of it was done fairly quickly and quietly, and not many people knew there was a vacancy.
Well, it was like a set of dominoes, you know. People were moved very quickly, and the domino that emerged, the last one standing, was Mr. Selmayr, and he became Secretary General at a meeting attended by all of the Commission. None of them knew this was happening. It wasn't even on the agenda. And when his predecessor stepped down, President Juncker immediately nominated.
Are you a bit like Chris Patten in the sense that you pay close attention to what's going on here, but you don't really want to talk about the specifics?
A bit like that.
In the context of government formation.
I was just saying at the meeting I was at this morning when I was in Strasbourg at the weekend of the election campaign. So I was caught between RT Player and Sky Go and radio and everything listening to it. Yeah, so it was enthralling, obviously. But I'm not a political commentator anymore. If that's the question you want to ask me, Sean.
Well, then in that case, we better go to a commercial break. Emily O'Reilly, European Ombudsman, thank you so much indeed for coming in.
Today with Sean O'Rourke on RTE Radio 1.